Hello, everyone, and welcome in to CrushTheStreak.com. I got another interesting guest, new guest on the line with me, the very popular Andre Polgar. We're going to be talking about a few things today: consumerism, the economy, insight on the debt slave economy. Maybe I'll ask him a question or two about, is Trump doing a good job, and kind of how that pertains to the economy going forward. We'll get into all of that today. Andre Polgar happens to be an economist, entrepreneur, investor. He's got a very popular YouTube channel. He does 1 Minute Economics, and he's a best-selling author by the Wall Street Journal. So, Andre, thanks for coming on the line with me today.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you guys for watching.
Andre, in one of your recent videos, you talked about debt slaves in the economy, and even people who don't have debt can possibly fall into this category. Enjoying the benefits of the debt-based economy now, you know, at the expense of future generations, that's another aspect of it. But I'd love to kick off our discussion here. Can you talk to us about that, you know, what that video was about, and, you know, what does it mean to have a debt-based economy, and, you know, how are we all impacted by this?
I mean, the thing is with today's consumer is that to a large degree, we have come to accept the unprecedented as status quo, if you will. You know, like, for example, we had the Great Recession, everyone was in full-fledged panic mode and whatever. And up until the Great Recession, the monetary base was, you know, $800-ish billion. Okay, fine. Fast forward to, you know, we had the crisis, we had the solution to the crisis, which involved QE, pumping money into the system, if you will. And essentially, how much money was pumped into the system? Well, at the height of it in the U.S., $85 or so billion per month, which means about $1 trillion per year, more in 1 year than had existed from 1913 up until the Great Recession. So we've kind of come to accept what many, you know, if you will, mainstream economists call unorthodox monetary policy. We've kind of accepted it as the status quo. And the same way we've accepted debt levels, which would have seemed ridiculously high a few generations ago, we accept those as the status quo as well. And, you know, a popular example is Japan, right? With a debt-to-GDP ratio of over 200%. You know, like, it is a bit ridiculous if you think about it, but this is the situation we find ourselves in. And even better yet, some of you might remember, you know, in 2010 or whatever, when Kyle Bass was on financial news networks explaining how Japan's debt level is a huge problem and how Japan's going to implode any minute now and whatever. So many traders at that point, they listened to those arguments. They were sound by any means. They made perfect sense. And of course, the case could be made, oh my God, this is the best trade of my lifetime. Let me just short Japanese government bonds. And nowadays, they call that trade the widowmaker for good reason, because it didn't age well, okay? So on the one hand, it is true that the market can stay irrational far, far longer than you can remain solvent. But this doesn't change the fact that we are on borrowed time, that we, yeah, are enjoying a bunch of benefits, whether we take on debt or not. Benefits of this debt-based system, and it cannot go on forever. Now, unlike many other economists, I kind of embrace my incompetence. Do I know for a fact exactly when this entire thing is going to implode? Of course I don't, you know. But what I can tell people is that it makes sense, and this is why when launching my second book, I was on so many interviews, I reached out to so many audiences to kind of tell people, look, I have no idea when this is going to end. This may very well last far longer than most people think, or this could end next year. I don't know. But what I do know is it does make sense to understand that we are in, and that's why I've chosen this name for my second book, we are living in an age of anomaly, and hedge accordingly. Like, that's the best I've got, pretty much.
So what I'm hearing is, you know, we can see all these metrics that would have otherwise been crazy decades ago or generations ago, but these same metrics applied now and we're seeing now are not necessarily acting in the way that we would have historically used them. It's like, you know, fundamental analysis failing in a sense. You know what I mean? And I think a lot of us look at this and go, you know, how is this possible that, you know, we're now 9 years into this historic bull market based on money printing, based on ultra low interest rates? How does the market not price this in and reflect it in asset prices, reflect it in the currency? You know, the dollar, you know, we're scratching our heads. Why is it valued so much considering all that's been done to it? You know, why isn't gold so much higher? You know, based on all of these historical things, all these historical fundamentals that would have otherwise suggested, you know, many reversions, right? So it's almost like you can't predict with precise certainty what is going to happen. And I'm just, you know, agreeing with you on this, but, you know, it's like every cycle is different. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And this has posed a huge problem for many economists, because a linear way of thinking would have been, hey, if they pump money into the system, the result is going to be, of course, very high inflation. Except that didn't happen, and it didn't happen because a central bank can control how much money it quote-unquote prints, but it cannot control what happens next. And if you print a bunch of money, again, whatever, if you pump a bunch of money into the economy, but that money ends up in the reserves of the banking system, then of course you're not going to have inflation. If you print that money and physically hand out paper currency to each and every person, you're going to have inflation. But if that money just sits as reserves in the banking system, you're not going to have inflation. And as time passes, and as, you know, that money starts eventually kind of doing its things, the result is inflation. But it's not the type of inflation you would have expected initially with a linear way of thinking. We have inflation when it comes to all sorts of assets. Look at the stock market right now, you know. Look at a bunch of other smaller pockets of anomaly, like what happened to cryptocurrencies, or like what happened in 2015 to 2016. I think I'm the only economist who even covered this. The short domain mania, when you had certain domains due to huge interest from China go from being worth $8 a piece to being worth over $2,000 each. So these pockets of anomaly, when you see them in the broader context, you do kind of understand that it's the market's way of trying to wrap its head around what's happening, you know? So of course we don't have inflation in the price of everyday goods. We don't have that, but we do have, essentially, this is my best description. It's the market trying to wrap its head around an unprecedented situation, because it's unprecedented for many reasons. Like, never ever has it happened that the world was so financially interconnected as it is today. So what do you do? Like, it would have been the easiest thing in the world if only the United States would have embarked on aggressive monetary policy from the perspective of the market. But what do you do? You being the market, what do you do when everyone does it? How do you price it in, as you've mentioned? How do you react to this? And it's this way of events unfolding that baffles economists. And not only that, you've witnessed firsthand just how many people have made prediction after prediction. You know, you've had flavor of the month economists who, you know, out-predicted each other. The next financial crisis is going to start 6 months from now. No, it's going to start 1 year from now. And it's reached such ridiculous levels that the entire idea of financial preparedness has kind of been discredited in the eyes of the general public, precisely because when you see so many economists make predictions, and when you see prediction after prediction after prediction fail, you cannot help but question the legitimacy of the entire thing.
Sure.
And That's pretty much the situation we find ourselves in. And unlike other economists, I don't have the habit of branding myself as this providential figure who has all of the answers. I don't know. Like, do I know for a fact what happens next? No, I don't. But unlike many of my peers, I take this incompetence of mine when it comes to predicting the future, and I actually base my entire strategy around it. So as much as people would like me, perhaps, to be this providential figure who has all of the answers and, hey, just buy my book. You don't even have to read it. Just buy it and everything will go away and everything's going to be just... That's not what I'm selling. You know, what I tell people is, you know, read my books, watch my stuff on YouTube, be informed. And as the market keeps trying to wrap its head around what's happening, you're going to be in a good position to react.
Yeah, I like that analysis quite a bit. So I guess to follow up on that, you know, many feel like the currency devaluation is coming. And you already talked about how it's already set in into different aspects. And you touched on the stock market. And, you know, many would agree, and I would look at the fundamentals and say the stock market is expensive now. But if we do go into some sort of currency crisis where the dollar does devalue in a big way, is the stock market potentially a safe haven in the event that we do see a currency crisis, even though we are in an expensive environment?
Yes. And the same way people find my perspective on real estate, for example, weird, because they're like, okay, so you've written this huge book about financial calamities. Yeah, you're concerned about the economy. Sure. So this means you're telling me to sell all my resale real estate because prices are going to collapse. No. And this baffles people because they would expect me naturally to be bearish on real estate. But the problem is this. What I'm afraid of is not necessarily your run-of-the-mill deflationary event where you have a crash, of course, real estate corrects and whatever. No. What worries me is a change of narrative because eventually, in my opinion, I have no idea when, but in my opinion, eventually the narrative is going to change. Like you had the dot-com bubble, you know, everyone was panicking, but don't worry. Central banks to the rescue. We're going to lower interest rates to 1%, which was a huge deal back then. And we saved the day. Fast forward to 07, 08. Once again, we have a crisis. Don't worry about it. Central banks have it under control. But you know what? We're going to have to lower interest rates to zero. And we're going to have to pump up to $1 trillion per year in the US into the system, even more so in the European Union at the height of its QE and so on. What worries me is, yeah, of course, we're going to have another event, another deflationary crash like we had. Once again, people are going to panic. Central bankers and those in charge of the government have all of the reasons in the world to want to kick the can down the road further. But what happens when this narrative changes? And they're going to say, okay, yeah, don't worry. We have it all under control. We're going to lower interest rates maybe to -1%, and we're going to pump $3 trillion per year into the system. What happens if the market says no? You know, like, of course, if you think you're the most brilliant speculator in the world, then yeah, sell your real estate before the crash, buy back in, and acquire better real estate after prices corrected. And then should the narrative change and governments and central banks lose control, which obviously would result in a downward spiral when it comes to currencies, then yes, the real estate you just reacquired will act as a safe haven. But do you really think, that's my, you know, hypothetical question to those who are baffled by my attitude, you know, do you really think you're going to be able to pull it off? Like personally, I invest in real estate over here in Romania, you know, my attitude, and this is the attitude of someone who actually does invest in various things from real estate to domain names to crypto to you name it. At this point, I'm not buying more real estate necessarily, except for one thing that I need, you know, for a side business with my wife, but that's not an investment in real estate per se. But as an investor, I wouldn't be acquiring real estate right now. But I wouldn't be selling the real estate I already have. And therein lies the key because, yeah, when this narrative changes and when we go from deflationary crash, recovery, deflationary crash, recovery to deflationary crash, attempted recovery, but then a loss of control, that's when you start getting in trouble. And that's, in my opinion, the elephant in the room. You know, people talk about stocks, people talk about real estate, but the elephant in the room, I feel, is people's confidence in the status quo, people's confidence in the ability of governments and central banks to keep these, you know, to keep these systems going. And when that confidence disappears, I have no idea when, once again, but when it does, all bets are off. And in that case, is real estate going to be a hedge? You bet it is. Are stocks going to be? Yes. Anything that's not directly tied, like government bonds or whatever, anything that's not directly tied to people's confidence in the quote-unquote status quo is going to potentially act as a hedge. And therefore, while my attitude when it comes to stocks, when it comes to real estate or whatever, while it may seem weird initially, it's not. It's not. Because when you're preparing for the unprecedented, it's not enough to adopt a reactionary strategy. You do have to try to think multiple steps ahead and kind of try to hedge to the best of your ability.
Yeah. No, that's really powerful. And, you know, one of the things that you talked about in one of your recent videos was retirement, good or bad, you know, is it possible? You know, these sort of questions, you know, and my question is, you know, in this low interest rate economy, in theory, it's a good thing for retirees to have a lump sum and to be able to get a higher interest rate on that lump sum if interest rates go up. But it's, I think you would agree with this, it's more complicated than that, because higher interest rates have consequences for everything that's been done and all the debt that we've taken on and the economy. And, you know, if we do have higher interest rates, does it, you know, initially bring asset prices down, which essentially negates any sort of higher return you'll get on some sort of interest payment? So, you know, what are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts towards retirees? How do they protect themselves? And, you know, I know it's not a one size fits all magic pill answer, but, you know, how do we wrap our minds around this for retirees here in 2018?
You know how the narrative changed from, like, you go to school, you don't have a job, and you work in the same factory for 40 years, and then you retire. You know, that ship has sailed, and today's workforce looks remarkably different than it did back in the day. And the same way, I do think that this particular narrative, like, you go to school, now the narrative has changed, you don't necessarily get just one job that you keep forever. Maybe you get multiple jobs, but then don't worry, you retire, and everything's taken care of. I think that narrative is not sustainable. And as someone who is looking at retiring, it's on you to figure these things out. You know, if you think you can just rely on, you know, some savings and just the basis status quo attitude to retirement that most people had, you're probably going to get decimated. So essentially, what you do next is up to you. What I do personally, like, if I wanted to desperately, I could retire tomorrow and live off rent income that I have from real estate. That's one option. Of course, you have your full one, you know, your retirement accounts, you have that. Okay, that's something else. Maybe you have a bit of crypto. Maybe you have some precious metals. Yes. There aren't that many. It's not a question that you answer, you know, just in black or white, you know, like, as the person who followed, you know, who came after Mao in China used to say, it doesn't matter if the cat is black or white. It matters that it catches mice. So that's kind of the thing right now. You have to adapt. In my opinion, the name of the game, just like today, the name of the game, if you want to be well-equipped to handle the situation in the workforce today, you have to be flexible. The same way, if you want to plan your retirement properly, you have to be flexible. If you just rely on the existing systems for your retirement, then you're playing with fire. Maybe you're going to be one of the lucky ones, and maybe until you die, these systems are going to continue functioning well enough, and it's going to be just great. But I, for one, would not choose, to be elegant, I would call that a suboptimal approach. Yeah. So I, once again, there's going to come a time when just people are going to have to be more responsible when it comes to their financial future. You know, they're not going to be able to plead ignorance, just like today's worker is not able to plead ignorance and say, hey, I was expecting the workforce to look like it looked 50 years ago. Tough luck, you know. And now more than ever, and it's kind of been one of my main reasons for starting One Minute Economics, the YouTube channel, for writing books and so on. Now more than ever, I believe there's no escaping economics, you know. You have to know your basic economics. You have to be able to kind of, you know, think for yourself when it comes to matters of economics, because whether you realize it or not, you're making economic decisions each and every day. And as the more time passes and the more our current systems are going to be showing their limits, the more important it's going to be for you to be on top of your game. And it's not that difficult to do, but you do have to assume, like, more financial responsibility now than you did in the past. Mm.
You know, one of the things that you said really struck a nerve with me. And, you know, you talked about how if you needed to, you could retire tomorrow and live off rental income. And that resonated with me because it's a powerful thing. It's I feel like that's where people need to get, and that's where people need to focus on when they want to retire, is operating in abundance. Because if you get so dependent on, you know, everything you have, and you have to optimize every gain in the stock market for you to pay your expenses. You have to optimize every ounce of your Social Security payment, and, you know, you're going to be, you're on the brink of disaster. But it's really getting to that point where you can operate in abundance, and then you just do your best with what's above and beyond that for your savings, for additional income, but really about solidifying those basic expenses and those basic needs with a certain amount of money, solidifying that, and then going beyond that, and again, operating in abundance. And I really think that's a powerful principle that people need to wrap their minds around. And if you're young, it's easier to do, to prepare for when you're older. If you're older, still possible, but get into that mindset and get to that spot. So I'm glad you said that. Andre, seeing the way governments, did you have anything that you wanted to say about that before I switch topics?
Just one quick principle that I tell people I personally adhere to. Like, I don't believe in being a doom and gloom type person necessarily, you know, thinking that, by all means, be an optimist in life, be optimistic when it comes to everything. But when making plans, that's when you should be pessimistic, in my opinion. Like, what's your main plan? Well, my main plan is relying on today's systems for retirement. Great. What if that fails? Well, I have my backup plan. Great. What if that fails? You know, it's kind of going down that road that's going to make the difference, I feel, between someone who is prepared and someone who isn't. It's simple. Be optimistic in life, but when planning, please do it for me. Be pessimistic.
Yes. Hope for the best, plan for the worst, right?
Pretty much.
So seeing the way governments have gotten so reckless, it's no wonder why many wish the currency has been backed by gold for so many years. You know, even prior to the gold standard being broken, it was recklessness that forced the hand of government to break away from the gold standard. It was, you know, even the gold standard didn't contain the government, right? You know, it got to the point where it went beyond the gold standard. So, in your opinion, I'd like to ask you, you know, what are the pros of the gold standard, and you know, what are some of the cons? Because you know, economics is like we've been talking about; it's not a one-size-fits-all magic pill, perfect scenario. You know, there's so many different variables, and things are always changing. And you, to use your word, it's not this linear thing. So it's theoretical. So you know, what are some of the pros and cons of the gold standard? And you know, really, I'd like to ask you about maybe what are some of the cons of the gold standard.
Now, when talking about my book during the launch week, and when going on so many YouTube channels, on so many platforms, I've gotten to talk to people from, you know, a wide range of places in this world. Like, we have people, of course, who think it would be a good idea to return to the gold standard. Then we have people who think, no, we should have some kind of a crypto-based standard because this would be possible to implement, and for these reasons, it would be a good choice. What I tell all of them is that the gold standard, the crypto standard, the cattle standard, the seashell standard, or any other standard that you're going to implement, it's not going to solve all your problems. It's not going to solve, you know, problems that have to do with human nature. Like, you can have the most rock-solid gold standard in the world. It's not going to save you from, for example, recklessness of those in the state. You know, if those who run the country are reckless and run deficits and so on and so forth, the gold standards is not going to save you against that. The gold standard is an option, of course. By all means, it's something which can be done. Some people consider that sound money. I understand perfectly why people would consider money backed on the gold standard sound money, but these aren't things that are going to fix not even most of the problems that are inherent to human nature. So is it an option worth exploring? Yes. Do I think we're going to return to a gold standard? Probably not.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with you on that. And I agree that it's probably not perfect, but it's, I guess what a lot of people like about it and where I agree or what I believe is that a gold standard, in theory, if money was truly tied and they couldn't just do what Nixon did and completely cut off from it, despite what government does, you have gold ultimately at the bottom. And that's what protects the people, because the way things are now, and we've seen it with countries around the world, is when governments get reckless, it's the citizens that suffer. And at least in a gold standard, in theory, you have gold ultimately if you know, that where they can't destroy the currency.
They cannot destroy the currency, but, you know, historically speaking, humans have this natural tendency, maybe it's an innate talent of ours, to wreck any system imaginable. So, you know, right from you had ancient Greece, right? The country which is, you know, kind of like the bastion of democracy, the place where democracy was born, but at the same time, it's the first example of ultra mega inflationary consequences that come from debasing your currency. So people are pretty creative when it comes to that. And that is kind of a circular type situation because it brings us right back to what I've said previously. We can have a gold standard, but eventually there's going to be a way to game that system. And just like everything else, make no mistake, of course, gold has a lot of things going for it. But at the end of the day, it would be, in my opinion, a huge mistake to not understand that even systems based on the gold standard are still subject to the most powerful driving force of economics, if you will, confidence. Because at the end of the day, it's always a cycle. It's always a cycle. And if people assume that confidence loss or anything of that nature is not possible under the gold standard, they would be mistaken. Now, I do understand why people think the idea of having a gold standard is attractive, you know, especially people who are financially responsible, people who save money. It's frustrating from your perspective as a saver, as someone who does the right thing, to notice that essentially currency is being pumped into the system like there's no tomorrow, and you kind of take that as a direct offense, you know, as someone who saves money. I do understand that. But inherently, history has proven that the gold standard is not perfect. And history has also proven that any system, essentially, be it gold standard or otherwise, is eventually going to be gamed by human nature. So at the end of the day, I just don't see it happening. Like, I'm not saying it's the worst idea in the world. I personally just don't see it happening.
Sure. No, I understood. I'm open-minded enough to understand what you're saying, how systems in general, especially as complicated as, you know, a monetary system that's supposed to serve the purpose for, you know, millions and billions of people, really. How it's problematic to get it right across the board. And I guess it's why as individuals, it's our responsibility to stay vigilant and to just make the best decisions possible to preserve our purchasing power. And that's another thing. You know, this concept of saving has evolved for thousands of years. I mean, from going way back when it was a matter of, you know, hunting and gathering and just saving to survive for the winter. And we've come a long way since then. For people now are able to, you know, work for 40 years and contain all of that effort and work and purchasing power in some sort of vehicle, whether it's stocks or real estate or what have you. I mean, and it's a concept I think we take for granted, this ability to save our purchasing power. You know, we're all accustomed to wanting to make money, but the beauty of preserving that, it's you know, don't take that for granted. It's a very beautiful thing. And, you know, you have to, you know, stay vigilant as trends change.
Exactly. This is what I wanted to point out. It's an amazing thing, but at the same time, it's a volatile dimension of our existence. Like, time and time again, history has proven that those who adopt a passive attitude when it comes to the idea of preserving your purchasing power, of doing the responsible thing and so on, it's not a set it and forget it thing. And that's the main problem I have with many people when it comes to their expectations from economists. You know, they would kind of like us, if you will, to present the basic blueprint. This is what you have to do. These are the things you have to set in motion. And as of a certain point, you can just, you know, relax and everything's going to sort itself out. That's not going to happen. Things are constantly evolving. Things change. And just look at how many times throughout history, massive transfers of wealth have taken place. And they've always been transfers of wealth away from the unprepared to the prepared. And being prepared just basically revolves around assuming responsibility for the financial dimension of your life. It means keeping your eyes open. It means understanding. That's why in my book, for example, I have tons of historic case studies. I don't just do it because I like telling stories. I do it because you don't study history, you know, just because you assume it's going to repeat itself. No, you study history because history gives us a proper understanding of human nature. And this understanding of human nature is going to make us understand why the gold standard isn't perfect, why our current system isn't perfect, why nothing in this world is perfect, and why the only thing we can do, essentially, is stay on guard. It sounds discouraging maybe to some, you know. It sounds kind of like you have the Matrix with the blue pill and the red pill, but it's the best I've got. You know, the best I've got essentially is to tell you to just accept how much unknown there is in the system, to assume responsibility for your actions, and to navigate this craziness that we call the financial system as best as you can.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm grateful for 2018. I got air conditioning. I live in a house.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't born 3,000-4,000 years ago, living in the middle of some, you know, jungle and having to fight for my survival and food. So, you know, staying vigilant, depending on when you were born into this life, could mean a whole lot of different things, right? So I'm glad we're here where we are today. And I would agree with you, stay vigilant and, you know, operate in abundance, get to that point where you're thriving and you really solidify your moat. And I think that's very important for people here. Andre, I said I would talk about this. Just a short comment, maybe. Is Trump doing a good or bad job for the U.S., you know, around the world? What's your thought on Trump? It's probably a loaded question with a very complex answer, but, you know, if you can give us some short and sweet type of analysis on this, what are your thoughts?
The current situation that I'm seeing, not just in the U.S., but also worldwide, with Trump being a good example, is awful. It's not awful because, you know, the best solutions are the ones offered by Republicans, or no, the best solutions are offered by Democrats. No, what worries me is the crazy levels of polarization that exist in the world at this point. It's just insanely crazy when you see that kind of the divide in the U.S. when, you know, the recent elections, instead of, essentially, elections should be a democratic exercise where people say, look, I root for this side, you root for that side, but after the elections are over, we're going to work together, and, you know, that's basically the essence of democracy. What happened, and not just in the U.S., but worldwide, is that Republicans became even more Republican and Democrats became even more Democrats. You had people who manifested, you know, who hated each other during the campaign, hating each other even more after the elections were over. We are seeing the exact same thing here in Europe. There's a huge, huge growing divide. There's a huge divide within countries of the European Union to an extent that the entire European project is being questioned. And as someone who does tend to have the habit of studying history, I do have to say that while we cannot be certain of anything, historically speaking, whenever things of this nature happen, the results aren't pretty. So what I'm seeing politically everywhere, and this craziness that's happening in the United States, you know, between the pro-Trump camp and the, you know, Trump is awful camp on the other, these exact same thing, make no mistakes, these exact same things are manifesting themselves over here in Europe as well, internationally as well, even when it comes to relationships between countries, and this leads to nothing good, historically speaking. So personally, and it's perfectly natural to ask me about the political dimension, I think the political dimension worldwide in general and in the US in particular is yet another pocket of anomaly that should make us concerned. We have pockets of anomaly related to our economy. We have pockets of anomaly related to the political landscape, and all of them individually are major causes for concern. But please study economic history, see what has happened in the past when humans ended up embracing the mindset that humans are embracing today, And I think you're going to discover many causes for concern. So as much as I am just like you, all about, you know, embracing a view on life that has to do with abundance and gratitude for the fact that, you know, we have the internet, we have smartphones. Today, someone from the middle class in the US, let's say, lives better than someone from the royal family not that long ago, you know. So this, in and of itself, this is a huge advantage. But at the same time, there are moments of what I call moral wandering in the history of mankind. And I think we're in the middle of such a moment, and we do need, at least in a small way, to prepare for the possible consequences of that. So to answer your question, I'm very, very concerned, and I do follow these things pretty closely about the situation in the US.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I could go on with this conversation for quite a while, but I want to keep this at around 30 minutes. Maybe we'll have to do another follow-up interview here. I'm greatly enjoying this. Andre, if people want to learn more about you and the work you're doing, buy your books, where would they go and what would they expect? What can they expect to find?
If they want to get in touch with me, they can just head on over to youtube.com/OneMinuteEconomics. I'm pretty easy to reach. You can go to the About section of my YouTube channel, find my email address the same way. You can just maybe write a comment, and I do my best, even if I don't always succeed at it, to keep up to date with what people are writing in the comments and answer to the best of my ability. So the easiest way to reach me is to just head over to my YouTube channel, search for OneMinuteEconomics on Google, and you'll end up there. And as far as my books are concerned, my most recent one, The Age of Anomaly, as well as my first one, Wealth Management 2.0, can be found pretty much everywhere books are sold. They can be found on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, on Kobo, on iBooks. So yeah. The Age of Anomaly, Wealth Management 2.0, OneMinuteEconomics, Google any one of these terms, and you're going to find me easily.
Andre, thanks so much for coming on Crush the Street. I really appreciate your insight today.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I really hope people manage to extract a ton of value from our conversation.